Philippians chapter 3, we pick up in verse 1. Paul says, "Finally, my brothers and sisters, rejoice in the Lord." Finally, with 40% of the letter ahead of him, he says, "Finally." Kind of sounds like a lot of Bible teachers I've heard before. In conclusion, and 20 minutes later, they're finishing up. He says, "To write the same things again is no trouble to me, and it is a safeguard for you." What are these same things? He says, "Rejoice in the Lord." He keeps repeating that throughout the letter. Indeed, this comes up something like 14, 15, 16 times in this little four-chapter letter about rejoicing. And Paul says, "I'm going to say it, and I'm going to write it, and then I'm going to say it and write it again." And he says, "It doesn't bother me at all, and it's a safeguard for you." The word here is literally like to trip, and it's going to protect you from tripping. So for those of us who are tired of hearing about, joy is the key to the Christian life and rejoicing and gratitude, I'm so sick of hearing about this, and I keep hearing these same things over and over. That is a red flag, according to Paul. He says, actually, the Christian life is making the main things the plain things and the plain things the main things and keeping these as the foundation of your life. The question is not, have I heard this before? The question is, rather, is this truth a life-transforming reality to me? Is it drilled down into my heart to the point where this is central and foundational to my very life and being? And Paul says, I've got no problem repeating that. Then he makes a little segue here. He says, segue is not the right word. He makes a 90-degree turn here. And he says, beware of the dogs, beware of the evil doers, evil workers, beware of the false circumcision. Dogs, he calls these people dogs. Well, as we read this letter, we know that these are religious Jewish teachers that are trying to come in and bring in law. Now, Paul himself is Jewish. Paul himself, formerly, as he's going to tell us, was a religious Jewish teacher who taught these very same things. And later, he's going to say that he's speaking about these people with tears in his very eyes in verses 18 and 19 of this chapter. But here he calls it like it is. He says, these guys are dogs. And you're probably like, well, that's not that bad. Like, how could you not love that little face there looking up at you, those little eyes and that little nose? No, in the ancient world and even in the Eastern world today, they don't treat dogs like little pets. Dogs are viewed as scavengers. They're mangy. God, we read in the Bible, for example, this word kion, which is the root word for canine. In English, in the Bible, this word dog is almost universally negative. So think of when David goes out to meet Goliath and he says, are you like a dog that's come out to face me? Or Jesus in Matthew 7, where he says, do not throw your pearls before swine. Do not give what is holy to dogs. Again and again and again. And it isn't saying that, God created dogs to be evil. This is being used as a metaphor to describe people as these scavengers. It isn't saying that God created dogs to be evil. Otherwise, it would refer to cats. Enough said. Outside of the Bible, rabbis used the term for Gentiles. So, in the next century, Rabbi Akiva could say to Governor Rufinus, what I named my two dogs, Governor? What? Well, I named them Rufus and Rufina, after you and your wife. See, this was viewed as a pejorative insult to people. And so Paul this is name calling. This is basically saying they're dogs. It's like they're mangy scavengers coming in, nipping at his heels, barking their teachings, animalistic, trying to pick people off. They were dangerous. They carried disease. And Paul is seeing a metaphor here with these false teachers. So too, he calls them evil workers. Interestingly, this is ironic, it's wordplay. These teachers were saying that, you don't need grace, you don't need faith. What you need are good works. And Paul says, these guys teaching good works, they're actually evil workers. So too, he refers to them as the false circumcision. This one's my favorite. Circumcision comes from two words, para, think perimeter, around, and tome, or a temno, meaning to cut. So circumcision would be para tome, to cut around. False circumcision comes from the two words kata tome. Kata means through. So kata tome would not be perimeter, but through. Paul is literally saying, now imagine if I said something like this. Those false teachers are like men with mutilated genitals. I would be getting a lot of emails after this teaching, right? But it's in the Bible. I'm reading from the Bible. And so part of what we're seeing here is that what we need to do is actually conform our views and what we find offensive to the Bible rather than importing what we think is offensive to the Bible. Why is this strong language? Because the subject which Paul is going to address is that of legalism, which isn't just something that is taught in the Bible. Many things are taught in the Bible. This is something that is emphasized. It comes up in church after church after church in the New Testament. It comes up with this sort of language, the language of emphasis or emphatic language, using strong language and even pejorative terms to speak of the teachers who hold these views. Or think of a Galatians chapter 1 where Paul says, if anyone teaches to you this different message, let God damn them. Literally, the word is anathema, to come under the curse and the wrath of God. That is emphatic language. This isn't just a teaching. It's repeated, and it is met with words of emphasis or anger. And so, when we see language like this, this is actually a good case in point. We don't want to turn the Bible into PG-13. We don't want to make it the made-for-TV Bible. When it uses this language, we should teach the visceral, vivid language that it uses, because it's trying to shock us, to describe just how pernicious and sick legalistic teaching is. You say, well, wait a minute. I don't even know what you're talking about. Legalism. Let me define. Legalism is the view that we use an improper use of rules or laws. It is the view that uses an improper use of rules or laws. So think of 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 8. The law is good if one uses it lawfully. So what is legalism? The improper use of rules and laws. So this could mean that you're trying to earn your way to God through rules and laws. That's what Paul is going to expand upon in this chapter. So two, it could be an improper use of rules and laws in the sense that you become desperate for other people's approval. Jesus was the one who said in Matthew chapter 23, he says, the Pharisees, these religious teachers, they love to be acknowledged by men. They love to be called rabbi. He says in John 5:44, he says, how can you believe when you seek the glory of people? How can you believe in God when you seek glory from other people? Legalism can result in trying to keep up appearances. As Jesus says, you like to clean the outside of the cup, but the inside is full of hypocrisy. You know, if it came to me and I had the choice of having sewage on the outside of my cup or sewage on the inside of my cup, I would rather have it on the outside. Are you with me? Now, preferably, I would like a no sewage cup. Like, I wouldn't like that either. But so I'm not saying what you do on the outside doesn't matter. Neither is Jesus. What he's saying is you love to keep up appearances on the outside when inside it's filled with rot and death and hypocrisy. That is legalism. Or harmful and arbitrary rules. Now, some people say, wait a minute, rules? I thought we're under grace. Well, God has imperatives in the New Testament. What are those? I mean, you can call them whatever you want. Imperatives, rules, direction, morality. I don't know what you call it. Now, we're not saying that you're punished by God if you don't live up to these rules. We're not saying that God is going to curse your life or that he hates you. But we are saying that like every social group on planet Earth, there are certain moral boundaries. Well, the same thing is true here. Here's the difference. When it comes to biblical Christianity, any moral imperative is there for our own good. Any moral imperative is there for our own good. So we can choose to follow it. We can choose to reject it. That's up to you. But it's there for our own good. Jesus says, however, the religious teachers of his day, he says, you love to heave these big burdens on men's shoulders, and you don't even lift a finger to help them. How does that contrast with Matthew 11:28, where Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdensome, and I will give you rest." See, Jesus wants to give us rest from legalism, arbitrary rules, harmful rules, exceeding what's written, according to Paul in 1 Corinthians 4, where we're starting to make up all these different rules, and it's like, okay, not only is it weird, not only is it harmful, but it's just downright arbitrary. Where did we come up with this? Why do we do it that way? And all of a sudden, this becomes canon, and I can't find it anywhere in my Bible. It's not helping anybody. Why is this the norm? That's legalism. So too, a sign of legalism would be fearful anticipation. I had a friend come to me and he said, "You know, for the last year and a half, whenever I would go to hang out with a friend, I kept anticipating that they were going to have a negative criticism of something that I was doing." Think about that for a moment. Every time he went to meet with a friend, a Christian brother or sister, he was expecting that there was going to be something critical or negative said to him. I said, "Was there anything ever critical or negative?" He said, "No." So the legalism actually wasn't out there with people. The legalism was in here. That's why we should be careful when we say to people, "You're putting me under law." Wait a minute. Nobody puts you under law. You put you under law. You choose to be put under law, whether you're going to ascribe to that or not. And Paul was always, they're always trying to put him under law. And he was never willing to break underneath the weight of that. Yeah, John says there is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. That would be a sign of legalism entering your heart. So too with moral minutiae. You know what I mean by that? Minutiae is the little things. So like on the one hand, you could have like really big things that are emphasized in the Bible over and over and over with strong language, repetition. And the legalist won't look at that because that's too daunting. You know, like, I don't know, love. Trying to becoming like a loving, sacrificial, forgiving person. That's not something that you can get the 10-step program to for $29.95. You know what I mean? Like to become a loving, forgiving, wholesome, sacrificial person. That's too hard. So they'll focus on the little minutiae. There was a woman who came out to one of our Bible studies. She worked at a strip club as a professional there. She was into hardcore drugs. I don't mean weed. I mean hardcore drugs. She came in to a Bible study and she was offended at the foul language and the smoking. That, my friends, is legalism. That's basically pointing the finger at everyone else's faults when you have massive problems in your own life, and that should be a sign to all of us. What Jesus calls this is straining out the gnat and swallowing the camel. Like, think about that for a second. Like, you're looking at your cup and you're like, "Oh my God, there's a gnat in there. There's a gnat. Ooh. And then you chug down a camel." Think of the imagery there. "Oh yeah. Oh, I didn't like that foul language that you used." Meanwhile, you're getting into God knows what. And that is a red flag for legalism. How about this is a sign of legalism? Giving the bare minimum. Malachi chapter 1 verse 8, God says, "You know, you bring me your sacrifices, but they're like the leftovers. Like you're supposed to bring me your sheep or your goats, or your oxen, and they're supposed to be pristine according to Leviticus 16. He says, "But you bring me the ones that, you know, have three legs and one eye and they're kind of walking funny, and you give me your leftovers, your bare minimum." He says, "Is that not evil?" How many of us, if we came into a group of Christians who were lazier than anything, would say this is a highly legalistic group? And yet, according to the Bible, that is precisely what we're seeing. Highly legalistic, giving the very minimum that we can, rather than getting under the grace of God and the love of God to give out to others. Well, he says, "We are the true circumcision who worship in the Spirit of God." This term worship isn't like this, you know, where you sing and whatever. I mean, if that's what you do, that's what you do. But that's not what this is saying. This kind of worship is latruo. This was a word used in the Old Testament for priests serving in the temple. Paul says, great word. I'm going to take that and use it for Christian service. And he says, it isn't that we're serving out of self-effort. It's serving in the Spirit of God. So God is actually empowering me to serve out of his power. So if anything good comes of this, this isn't something that I did. This is something that the Spirit of God did through me, working through me. He says, we glory in Christ Jesus. This word here really means to boast. And it seems to me that we were made to boast in something or someone, that this is just the way that we were engineered, created. And according to the Bible, that's a healthy thing, to boast, but not to boast in self, but to boast in others, to boast in God. Here he says, we boast in Christ Jesus. Do you see how this is so different from legalism? Legalism is all about me and my comparison and my performance. This is all about God and what he can do through me. Then he says, negatively, we put no confidence in the flesh. To be confident means to rely on, to be convinced, to trust. I don't trust what? My flesh. This is a word used by Paul to describe self-effort, moral unction, you know, trying harder, trying even harder than before. To put confidence in the flesh means that I don't trust myself. I don't rely on my own power. I'm not convinced that I can do anything. Yet we read in Philippians 4:13, Paul says, I'm convinced that I can do all things through him who strengthens me. So I don't put any confidence in the flesh. Now, at this point, Paul's interlocutors, his opponents, these religious Jewish teachers who are teaching law, and they're trying to come in to pervert this message, this beautiful message of grace and forgiveness and love, and they're trying to say, no, you're not good enough, you're going to hell. Nice try. Yeah, you need Jesus, but you also need blank. At this point, his opponents would probably say, well, see, Paul, he teaches grace, free forgiveness, love, acceptance, because he probably tried the law and he just couldn't cut it. Not like us. Well, Paul addresses that here. He says in verse 4, he says, if we were to go the route of law, like if you want to talk law, you ready to talk law? You want to go head to head on the law? I'm ready for you, baby. Verse 4, I myself might have confidence even in the flesh. Wait a minute. He just said he doesn't have confidence in his flesh. He said, if we're going to hypothetically go that way, let me tell you, I am, of all people, I'm the one who could do it. He says, if anyone else has a mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more. I was circumcised on the eighth day. This is according to Leviticus chapter 12, where it says that mothers and fathers should circumcise their sons, according to the law, on the eighth day. And so what Paul is saying here is not that he as an eight-year-old boy, a little infant baby, could have circumcised himself. He's saying, rather, he grew up in a good, Jewish, God-fearing, godly household. Well, he's off to a good start. Incidentally, 2,000 years later, legalists use the same argument here. One might say, for example, or one might hear, I grew up in a Christian home and my parents had me baptized. Wait a minute. That's exactly what Paul is saying here. He says, I was circumcised on the eighth day. My parents baptized me. My parents circumcised me. I didn't have anything to do with that. It wasn't like I made a choice here. So this is interesting to think about. If we're going to go the way of law, if you think that you're a Christian because you were baptized or you grew up in a Christian home, do you mean that the truth of Christianity or any other spiritual worldview is based solely on what family you grew up in? Come on. I mean, remember grade school? You'd be on the playground and you'd be in an argument and you'd be like, well, well, my mom said so. And that was like the closing of the argument, you know? That's what this is, only we're adults. Okay, how many, real quick, show of hands, ready? You gotta vote. You have to vote. Ready? How many people here love their grandma? How many people love their grandma? Okay. That's pretty good. Okay, all right, good. How many people believe everything that their grandma believes? Nerd, sorry. I've done this before. Every time one guy's like, I do. What that shows is what? It shows that you can love someone and you can honor someone and respect someone, but that doesn't mean that you have to agree with everything that they believe. So too, it doesn't make it true. It doesn't make it true. Just because your mom or dad tell you something, that doesn't make it true. You'd have to have better reasons for that, to be sure. Well, Paul says, I was born into the nation of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin. He's saying, I grew up with a good heritage. tribe of Benjamin. I mean, that was the place from which we have the first king, Saul. Great, great heritage. I mean, he has the right pedigree, the right genetics, the right ancestry, the right ethnicity. So to today, 2,000 years later, we hear people say, well, I'm a Christian because I grew up in a Christian country. Now, I know there's the really rank version of this, where people believe that this is like God's chosen nation, and, you know, we're God's gift to the planet Earth, and we have, you know, the God-given constitution and the God-given, God-fearing founding fathers. And I know there's that whole version, and I don't want to be rude, but I will. Read a book. That's just not true. That is not true at all. Thomas Jefferson, for example, a deist, not a Christian. Benjamin Franklin, you know, the little Danny DeVito-looking guy. He used to get into libertine orgies. He was sleeping with excessively older women, younger women, and everything in between. Those are our really good Christian founding fathers that built this nation. Now, some of our founding fathers were Christian, and they lived in an environment where Christianity was considered a plausible belief system at the time. So was their influence? Sure. But I don't mean that. I don't mean Christian country or Christian nation in that sense. What I mean is, and I think what many people mean is, when we call this a Christian country, we don't mean theologically, we mean sociologically, that many people around here are Christians. But then that raises a question. You're a Christian because you grew up around a bunch of Christians? Does that mean the truth of God and who God is based on the geographical accident of where you were born? So if you had grown up in a different time, in a different place, in a different region, in a different home, those beliefs would be just as equally true? Well, of course not. If you had lived pre-Copernicus and you had believed in a geocentrism, that the universe circled around the earth, would that be true? No, even though you grew up in that culture? No, it wouldn't be true. Why? Because it's not true. That's why. It doesn't matter what country you were born in or what time. Then Paul says, a Hebrew of Hebrews, number 3. This could be a superlative, meaning like really, really Hebrew. Okay, that's possible. But he's already covered his ethnicity. Many commentators believe that this means that Paul could speak Hebrew in a day when most people couldn't. The common language was Greek, and he's saying, no, I could speak Hebrew. In other words, I had a great religious education. Again, 2,000 years later, I've talked to people and I've said, so what do you think about Christianity? I tried that before. Really? What do you think about it? Well, I grew up in a religious school, and so I've heard all about that, and yeah, I just don't buy it. Did you know that you can know facts about God without really knowing God? Imagine if me and my buddy, you know, after this meeting was over, we were sitting there and, you and your buddy, I'm married. You and your buddy are sitting there after this meeting and you're sitting around and you look across the room and you see a young lady and you turn to him and you say, hey, who's that over there? And he says, that over there, that's a Jane Doe. And you say, wow, what an exotic name that is. And you say, so what's she like? Do you know her? Oh yeah, I know her. She's 22 years old and, she's about to finish up an art degree and she just went to Venezuela on a relief trip to help the poor. And, her favorite food is burritos from Chipotle and her favorite series is Grey's Anatomy. And, she's been single for 7 months and 3 weeks and 1 day. And you're like, that's oddly specific. How do you know that? He says, well, I'm friends with her on Facebook. And you say, wait a minute. Have you ever met her before? And he says, well, no, but I know her from Facebook, man. What's the problem? Would that not be the creepiest thing you've ever heard? What you're doing if you say this is I'm Facebook stalking God. I don't actually know God. I know things about God, but I've never actually come into a relationship with God. As to the law, Paul writes, a Pharisee. This was a closed fraternity of 6,000 men, absolutely detailed and scrupulous with regard to the law. These guys wouldn't spit on the Sabbath because they're afraid their loogie would create some kind of a furrow and that would be considered farming. That was the Pharisees. And Paul says, as to the law, a Pharisee. I mean, this is, boom, that is the closing argument right there. Incidentally, many people today say the same thing. I'm a good person. My question? Define good. What if everything that you've ever written in a journal that captured, let's say, all of your thoughts and feelings and angers and anxieties and real opinions of people, let's say you kept it in a journal, and let's say that all of your nearest and dearest friends could read through that journal page by page, and they knew everything that you thought about them at every time, every word of gossip, every word of anger, every word of cruelty, every word of jealousy, and so on and so forth, every betrayal, everything was in this journal, and everyone in your life could read it. Would you feel like a good person? Well, better question, would your friends consider you a good person? Define good. Well, according to the Bible, goodness is not based on the standard of who you are. Goodness is based on God's own moral nature. And so goodness comes from Him. So what's Paul's point here? He's defending himself, where they're saying Paul taught grace because he couldn't cut it with the law. No, 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 no. Paul didn't try the law and failed. Paul tried the law and succeeded and realized that this whole operative system was bankrupt. Now, some people will say, well, isn't religion a good thing? I mean, to have, you know, rules and laws in your life. Look at how quickly this goes south. He says in verse 6, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church. Acts 22, verse 3, Paul says, I killed both men and women in pursuit. He sincerely believed in this. As to the righteousness which is found in the law, blameless. How self-righteous do you have to be to consider yourself blameless? No, religion doesn't lead to good things. Religion leads to self-righteousness. It leads to caricaturing other people to make them subhuman, to the point where we can actually kill them in the name of God. That's religion. No, that doesn't help anybody. And Paul says the same thing here. He says, but whatever things were gained to me, whatever things, those things he just said, all the benefits he got of being raised in that home and that heritage and that education and all of his good works, all of that, his life's work. He said, whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Jesus Christ. More than that, I count all things to be lost. It's like he's starting to think about that. Yeah, all those things I listed, I count them as a loss compared to knowing Jesus. Then he goes further and says, actually, not just those things, all things, anything else I could put up on that list, anything you could put up on that list, or me, our good looks, our intellect, our charisma, our sense of humor. Maybe you're the funny guy. Maybe you're the good-looking guy. Maybe you're the smart guy. And that is a fragile sense of identity. Why? Because you're just waiting for somebody smarter or funnier or more handsome or pretty or more athletic to come along, and then your identity is wrecked. Tell me I'm lying. All things are a loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things. Look at that. That identity, that self-improvement project of trying to make myself better, he says that doesn't compare, in fact, to the surpassing value. In other words, knowing Jesus gets better and better and better with time. Those things, all those things, after the years, they get worse and worse and worse with regard to their value. And he says, I count them but rubbish. I count them rubbish so that I may gain Christ. Yes, rubbish. Again, the translators are squeamish. Oh my, if a group of Christian translators published a Bible really translating this word, oh boy, there'd be people with torches and pickets and everything else outside the translation committee. You know what this word is? Scubalon. Scuba, it already sounds filthy. J.I. Packer, he says, nastiness and decay are the constant elements of its meaning. It is coarse, ugly, violent word implying worthlessness, uselessness, and repulsiveness. Paul's saying all of anything, all that, anything compared to knowing Jesus, it's that. BDAG, another academic Greek New Testament lexicon, translates it this way. It says, God, as opposed to the finery of this world, which in contrast is shit. Now, again, if you're offended at that, you need to get your moral sensibilities in line with the Bible and not try to get the Bible to be in line with your moral sensibilities. We're not going to bleep out the Bible. We're not giving the PG version of the Bible. Paul is cussing here. Now, I don't want anyone to walk out of here and say, that means I can cuss somebody out. Paul's using a cuss word, a filthy word, to describe his own life, not cussing out his roommate or his spouse. He concludes, all this, what is all this? I tried all that. I tried the self-improvement project and being a good person and following the law and the rules and the rituals. I tried all that and I counted rubbish. I counted dung. He says that I may be found in Jesus, him, Jesus, not having a righteousness of my own derived from law. That's self-righteousness, right? Not a right. We always hate self-righteous people. The problem is we're one of them. Not a righteousness of my own derived from law, but that which is through faith in Jesus Christ by trusting in his righteousness, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of faith. Do you see what this is saying? This is saying that in order to have a relationship with God, and hear me now, please. In order to have a relationship with God, I'm going to put this as clearly as I can. What you need to do is just say, I give up. I can't do it. I'm not good enough. I haven't followed the rules enough. I'm not righteous enough. But I know that you are. And I want your righteousness, what Jesus did on the cross, to apply to me. And I want to receive that so that when God looks at me, I want him to see the righteousness of Jesus Christ himself. I'm not making this up. See it for yourself right there. The righteousness which comes from God on the basis of faith. Think about it like this. This is what religion teaches. Various religions of different traditions and different ways teach it this way. In your current life, you're moving toward the afterlife, and there's all these good works and moral actions and rituals and religious practices that you need to do. And it's a self-improvement project. And at the end, when you get there, when you get to heaven, you get God's righteous verdict. You find out. You live in the peril of, am I going to heaven or hell for 30, 50, 80 years? And you hope that when you get there, that you'll get the thumbs up from God. You're righteous. I'm going to let you in. That's religion. That is not what we're reading here. The scandalous claim of the Bible is that you can have God's righteous verdict right now, tonight. You could walk out of this room knowing that you're made right with God. This is the message of grace. Not works, not religion, not rules, not rituals, none of that. Grace. And grace means a gift. And what God is asking from you tonight is to lower your self-righteousness and just say, I need the help. I need the gift. I've heard some people say, oh, I don't take handouts. Oh, you need this one. You need it so badly you don't even realize it. You will never, ever meet God's righteousness. You need his grace. So to conclude, Paul, he had a great upbringing. Nothing wrong with that. Great heritage, nothing wrong with that. Good education, good works, nothing wrong with any of these things. Here's what was wrong with it. None of these things were sufficient. This is why this message of grace is so offensive to people. Because people say, you know, I've been such a good person and I've done all these good things. And you're saying I'm just like that girl who is the stripper and the drug user and the prostitute. You're saying I'm just like her in the eyes of God. I'm a good person. That's exactly what I'm saying. That's why this is so, for some people, this is the best news in the world. And for others, this is the most offensive message in the world. Because the self-righteousness kicks in and they say, forget it. Not if I'm going to be compared to her. In the eyes of God, we are all desperately sick and need his help. The question is, are you banking your eternity on being good enough? Please, please don't walk out of here tonight doing that. On the biggest decision of your life you could ever make, you're trusting in your own self. You know, if there's one thing that COVID-19 is teaching us, it's that we aren't in control of our lives. And I don't say that to scare you. I know you're scared. I'm scared. We look out at our world and we see loved ones. We see family members. It's like we see that this is all headed. If there's one thing this horrible pandemic has done is arouse us and awaken us to the reality of death, that it's coming for each and every one of us. And the question that the Bible asks each one of us is, are you going to trust in your own righteousness and works and goodness? Or are you going to trust in what God has freely given you through Jesus?